Welcome to Cathedral Square, hosted by Father Christopher Smith, Episcopal Vicar and Rector of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. For the next hour, you'll have an opportunity to find out about some of the history, little-known facts, and the upcoming events at the beautiful campus on the corner of Chapman and Lewis, or as we like to say, at the intersection of faith and reason.
Welcome to Cathedral Square. I'm your host, Father Christopher Smith, Episcopal Vicar and Rector of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California, the cathedral for the Diocese of Orange. On Cathedral Square, we talk about all things Christ Cathedral. We've talked about the history and the development of the campus. We've talked about the dedication of the campus. We talk about the programming, the events, the activities, how we carry out the mission, the relationship of Christ Cathedral to the overall Diocese of Orange. Of course, a cathedral, as the mother church of a diocese, connects with every single facet of a local church. And that's why I'm so happy to have our special guest today. Our special guest is Monsignor John Urell, who is the pastor of St. Timothy Church in Laguna Niguel, California. And this is so special for me because Monsignor John and I are classmates. We were in the seminary together. We were ordained together. We both grew up in Orange County, and we've spent many, many years in ministry together as brother priests, and we're also friends. And so, Monsignor John, thank you so much for taking your time to be with us today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here, Christopher. Thanks for having me today.
Sure. Well, Monsignor, maybe you could just give our listeners a sense of your history here in the diocese, and I'll chime in too, because we share a lot of that history together.
We do. We remember when we were in the seminary and the news came that the Diocese of Orange was established. It was early in March of 1976, and all of a sudden, two or three of our faculty members, I remember Father Leveda and Father Niederauer especially, came through the halls of the seminary, knocking on the doors of all the seminarians who lived in Orange County to say, the Diocese of Orange has been established. And we didn't quite know what that meant. Remember?
I remember it very well. We had a lot of jokes, too, actually.
Well, we did, because the name of the bishop was William, so it'd be William of Orange. We heard that.
Yes.
And none of us really knew Bishop Johnson, who was going to be our first bishop, but we just knew there was a lot of excitement in the air. And one thing that we did was we changed out the white tab collars of our shirts to orange ones. Do you remember?
I do remember.
And then, those days of the beginning of the diocese and being part of the installation ceremony of Bishop Johnson and your home parish, Holy Family, being named the cathedral.
Yes.
Of the diocese. You had been there forever.
Yes.
All through school and your family.
Yeah, I probably am one of the few priests that have received all of my sacraments, including ordination, at the same parish.
At the same parish. Well, my home parish was St. Cecilia Parish in Tustin. And my pastor, Monsignor Salmon, when the diocese was established, was taken from our parish. He was asked by Bishop Johnson to become what was called the Episcopal Vicar for Pastoral and Community Affairs. Remember?
Yes, I do remember.
He was just sort of fondly known as Mr. Catholic or Father Catholic everywhere. Bishop Johnson even called him that because he was omnipresent at every gathering you could think of, both Catholic and interreligious and interfaith. It was wonderful. Anyway, growing up at St. Cecilia Parish, going through public schools, and then going to college at Long Beach State, a college in Long Beach. I finished that in 1972 and then entered the seminary. And that's where you and I met.
Yes, I remember it.
1972. And we were both juniors in college at the time.
Yes.
We began our work together as seminarians and then, and it was a quick 6 years until June 1978, when we were ordained priests.
Yes, and one of the things that it's always very special for me and for us, I know, is that we were the first class to be ordained priest for the newly established Diocese of Orange. And before that, we were the first class to be ordained as deacons for the Diocese of Orange in 1977.
Yes.
And I remember that day, it was kind of, as they would say, electric. The excitement was in there. Not so much about us personally. I think more about the idea that our first ordination as the new diocese.
And Bishop Johnson was so thrilled, so excited to have the first class being ordained. Of course, Father Rick Serra had been ordained a month before us at his home parish. He's the first priest ordained for the diocese, but yeah, we were the first class. And there were six of us ordained together. That was a great day, June 3rd, 1978. And then off we went.
And then off we went in many different assignments over the years.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was assigned to Holy Family Cathedral for my first 5 years, your home parish. And then after that, Bishop Johnson asked me to change ministries and to go into administrative work to become his priest secretary, which then launched me into going to USC School of Social Work.
That's right. Yes.
And
because he had his degree in social work too, right?
Bishop Johnson did. And Father Mike Driscoll, later Monsignor Mike Driscoll, later Bishop Driscoll, had his degree in social work from USC. And so Bishop Johnson said that he wanted me to go to USC to get a degree in social work, specializing in community organizing and planning and administration. He thought that would really do me well for the work that he had in mind for me later in the diocese.
Yes, and have you found that to be true?
I have. First of all, I found that studying social work was like second nature to me. It fit me perfectly. I didn't know what it was at first, but when I got into it, I found that it fit me perfectly. And when I was ordained in 1978, I had no idea this would happen to me, of course. We have no idea what's going to come. But in 1983, entering USC, becoming the bishop's secretary, finishing my degree in social work in 1986, and then, sadly enough, just 2 months later, Bishop Johnson died. Remember that?
Oh, I remember. We were there.
We were both there together.
We were both there together when he died. I will always remember it.
Very powerful moment as we began then the next chapter in the Diocese of Orange with new leadership when Bishop Steinbach became the administrator of the diocese. And then once finishing my degree in social work, I became what's called the vice chancellor, which I think was just a nice name to give me. I didn't exactly know what I was doing at the moment. But then Bishop McFarland was named our second bishop in February of 86.
You remember these things way better than me.
No, 1987, February. And then the diocese started taking off. We were growing. I remember Bishop Johnson told me once he didn't ever think that he was a good homilist. He said he didn't really think he ever had anything good to say as a homilist, but he knew how to organize a diocese.
Uh-huh.
And he knew how to choose people to run the diocese, and he chose really good people to do that. And one of them sitting right across from me, that's you, who then went off to get your degree in religious education.
Religious education, yes. That was at Bishop Johnson's request as well.
Yeah. In fact, all of our classmates.
Yeah, we all ended up going for further education.
Yes. Which is, you know, Father Christopher, that's a great gift in our diocese because our bishops, all of them, through the years have been very, very proactive in that.
Oh, it's been a great blessing for all of us, yes.
Even to today, we have priests in Rome finishing their degrees and in various disciplines, canon law especially, but we've had some great opportunities for priests of our diocese to get ongoing education, advanced degrees, to continue to serve the people of the diocese in so many ways.
Well, and the beautiful part about that is we had our education in the seminary with, the regular college subjects and then in theology and pastoral theology and pastoral ministry. And then the blessing of our further education kind of expanded our horizons in various fields. You're in social work, me in religious education, others in theology, scripture, canon law.
Mm-hmm.
So it really gives us a great panorama of expertise shared among us priests over the years here in the Diocese of Orange.
Yes. Oh, yes. I wish that I had had more opportunity to use the exact work of social work, you know, in ministry. But I was chosen to do other things in the diocese, in administrative jobs. And so working with Bishop McFarland, then became chancellor, and then later on became what's called the moderator of the Curia, the sort of the chief of staff for his diocesan staff. And that's when we started working together again, when you came back with your degree in religious education, and Monsignor Mike Hare came back with his degree in theology, and Father Jack Sewell, Father Bill Vosing with canon law. We all ended up working together.
At that part of time, we're all working for the diocese in one capacity. I was the director of the Office for Religious Education, Monsignor Mike, Family Life. I mean, it was just something.
We never thought we'd end up in that because we all loved parish work, which we still do.
Yes.
So, but those were great years. Challenging.
You know, I have to just go back just because of the year that it is, the year of St. Joseph. I remember when Monsignor was studying his social work, and he had to have, in my terminology, a project. And I remember the project, if that's the right term, was something that you called St. Joseph's Table.
Right. And instead of writing a master's thesis, it was to do a project, community organizing project. So working with Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles in Wilmington, we were able to procure a building there, and St. Joseph's Table was established May 1st, 1986, and it was a place for meals, for job referrals, for some medical help, for getting a shower. It was a place of hope for so many people out on the streets, especially who were drug ravaged and difficult times, you know, many, many vets and many people just down and out. What a blessing it was to establish that St. Joseph's Table and get so much help from the community, both Catholic and other faith traditions, helping and establishing that. Thanks for remembering that.
Oh, I always remember. I had great admiration for you in starting that, because it was a rather tough area that you started that, and it was really a great inspiration. Caring for the poor and those in need is something that's very essential to our Catholic life, and I hope that during this year of St. Joseph, that aspect of who we are as Catholics will be emphasized, especially in the tradition of that St. Joseph Table, which still goes on in, hopefully will go on again in many parishes.
Last year at St. Timothy Parish, where I am, our Knights of Columbus had decided to put together a huge St. Joseph Table. We always did a great St. Patrick celebration, but they said this year St. Joseph Table, and it was being taken care of by a number of women in the parish who had a long history in this. Everything was set to go, and then closed down.
Okay.
It was closed down like 3 days before. So disappointing.
Well, that's right, because the Feast of St. Joseph is March 19th, and I think the order to close the public services in the churches and all was March 17th.
Yes, yeah.
The Feast of St. Patrick.
Right, St. Patrick might have been upset with St. Timothy Parish for changing the focus.
Could have been. Who knows?
Anyway, yes, gosh. Well, let's see. Continuing on, I guess, with our ministry lives together after serving with Bishop McFarland in a number of roles, then Bishop McFarland named me pastor of St. Catherine of Siena Parish in 1997. I was thrilled to be there and was able to be there for three wonderful years with one of my parochial vicars is now Bishop Tim Fryer.
That's right.
He was there with me for a couple of years. And in the year 2000, I talked to Bishop Brown, then our third bishop, and said that it was just getting to be a bit too much to be vicar general for the diocese, as well as then to be pastor of a parish that was really expanding and growing. And all things were changing because Bishop Brown was new coming in.
Yeah.
So he mercifully let me go on my 25th anniversary when we had our 25th in 2003. And then I was named pastor of St. Norbert Parish.
Yes.
In Orange, a wonderful place where I served until 2008. And now, then I was assigned to St. Timothy Parish in Laguna Niguel, where I am now in my 13th year.
13th year. It just seems to me like yesterday that you were assigned to that parish. And you've been a wonderful pastor in these very parishes, these many parishes over the years. And we're going to take a break in just a minute, but when we come back, I would like to talk to you more about your role as pastor at St. Timothy. And I'd like to hear, looking to the past a little bit, what it was like for you and your parish when there was the announcement that perhaps the Diocese of Orange would purchase the Crystal Cathedral campus at that time, and then when the campus was actually purchased, and what that was like for your parish. So we'll take a break now, but please stay with us.
Saturday mornings are a little brighter with host Rick Howick in Orange County Catholic Radio. Here's a soundbite with a recent guest, Dr. Louise Dunn from the New Hope Crisis Hotline.
It's interesting, though, that even with people that tell us that they're atheists or agnostics, sometimes we ask them if they still want us to pray for them. How many people say, I can't hurt? So we still offer that. But if the person makes it clear up front they don't want that, of course, we don't pressure anybody in any way.
Check out OC Catholic Radio, Saturday mornings at 9 on Relevant Radio. Or come find the podcast at OCCatholic.com/radio. That's OCCatholic.com/radio.
Welcome back to Cathedral Square. I'm your host, Father Christopher Smith, Rector of Christ Cathedral in the Diocese of Orange, and my special guest today is Monsignor John Urell, who is pastor of St. Timothy Church in Laguna Niguel. We are classmates. We were ordained together. We are friends, and it's really nice to have Monsignor with us today. And we've been talking a bit about our past history here in the diocese and our journeys in the various ministries. And currently, Monsignor is serving as pastor of St. Timothy Church in Laguna Niguel. And Monsignor, I'd like to ask you, having served in a number of parishes as pastor and now at St. Timothy, maybe you could share with our listeners just a little bit about how you see your role as a pastor and some of the main elements of what that is for you personally.
Oh, my goodness. First of all, I see it as an incredible gift to be named a pastor and to serve as a pastor. Incredible gift from God for me to use gifts, talents, and abilities the Lord has given me to shepherd the people of St. Timothy Parish, to preach the word, to lead them in sacramental prayer, to encourage and enable the various ministries, especially as we're doing our outreach ministry to the poor and with our food pantry and St. Vincent de Paul Society, all of the various faith formation programs from what we call Tiny Tim's up until our oldest parishioners. To be a man of faith in the midst of men and women of faith. I always loved that image that when I would go to a parish or any of us would go to a parish, we're going into holy ground, place where God has already been and is present. And to go in and to be there to serve the best we can. I remember going to St. Timothy's thinking and praying because it's such a beautiful place and long history of great faith and great friendliness and great outreach. I remember praying quite a bit, Lord, just don't let me blow this.
Yes.
Let me keep
of
this
course.
Going
yeah.
and do what I can do and enable and encourage others to do what they can do. So I think the role of pastor is a very pivotal one because people are looking to one to give leadership, but also servant leadership. That's the kind of leadership that I think is most important for me as a pastor, to serve the needs of the people and to help with the folks of the parish to determine what are the needs of our people and how might we be able to meet them. In the midst of preaching the gospel, celebrating the sacraments, and our ministry to those who are in need, no matter what the need is.
Well, I agree with you. Having served as a pastor myself, it is a tremendous privilege to be able to have that role of shepherding a community, and you've done it so well over these years. And I know that you were named pastor of St. Timothy before Christ Cathedral was even a
right.
thought.
Right.
And probably were in the midst of maybe launching or being part of the launch of a capital campaign in the diocese, part of which would be going to fund the building of a new cathedral, which was going to be on another site, Christ Our Savior Parish.
Oh, yes.
In southern Santa Ana. And then the possibility of purchasing what was then Crystal Cathedral campus, and then the eventual purchase of it. Can you tell us what it was like for you to kind of anticipate that and maybe what the thought was among your parishioners at the time?
First of all, for me, I really loved Holy Family Cathedral.
Yes.
It is a great place of tremendous memory, not only of our ordination there, but then serving there for 5 years and really being more or less there for 20 years serving the bishops.
Yes.
In fact, in my office, I have a picture of the crucifix over the main altar there at Holy Family that I look at often because it was a great focus point for me to be there for prayer. Now, a new cathedral. When we're first looking at the cathedral, a possibility in Santa Ana, Christ Our Savior Cathedral, I was involved with in that time in the diocese with all the machinations and all the work to see about getting the land, working with Segerstrom Company and so many other people to see about procuring the land for it and the high quality that was wanted by both the diocese and the Segerstrom Company to build a beautiful cathedral for the Diocese of Orange because it certainly was needed. As we know, we outgrew Holy Family, so moving to a new place, for a cathedral just was exciting for me. And at that point, I was not necessarily in a parish. We were doing a lot of, I was still, it was in between my time at St. Catherine's, St. Norbert's. So the idea of it was marvelous. A lot on my mind, a lot going with and working with people for what it might look like, how we would raise the funds, et cetera, et cetera. When I was then full-time in parish, the idea sort of drifted to the back because, you know, what's on your plate is right in front of you
right
in the parish.
There, exactly.
And when then the name came, the time came, the ideas came rather about the diocese being in the position of perhaps purchasing this site of the Crystal Cathedral for Christ Cathedral, I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. I didn't know where that all came from. I thought it was a great idea, but at the same time I thought, my goodness, that's going to be a huge thing. Much bigger than building a cathedral and starting from scratch, but taking over a large piece of land with beautiful buildings and a whole background history and that. And so I remember thinking privately, well, good luck. Let's hope that works.
Yes.
And I remember coming up here and walking around one day after the deal had been done, and it was a cold, cloudy day, and I walked around here and I was depressed because it just looked old. It looked tired. And yet knowing there was such a marvelous history here of faith tradition, men and women of deep faith and loving the Lord, but the whole physical thing had grown tired. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to be a lot of work, but what a lot of promise. So for me, it was a mixed feeling, one of excitement and one of, I wonder if this can get, it's going to really happen.
Of course. And then it happened.
And I must say for the people of our parish, and many in the South County, for historical reasons, this seems like a long way away.
Yes, yes.
And I had a challenge and concern with the advisors in my parish for our capital campaign committee. How do we make a cathedral concept come alive? Because many of our people had never been to Holy Family Cathedral.
Yes, right.
And many people say, what a new cathedral. What is this? You know, and Christ Cathedral, what are we doing? And so we've embarked on an entire plan of education and formation to talk about, with your help and the help of so many others, what is a cathedral? What's the place of a cathedral? What does it mean to have a cathedral? And slowly but surely, quite a few people really got on the bandwagon, to use a phrase, and were very excited about something that looked like it would be a nice united or a unifying event in our diocese that would help to bring us together from north to south, east to west, throughout the entire diocese. So there was a beginnings of excitement about it.
Yes. Well, I think, Monsignor, your experience of it, you know, the kind of hesitation and wonderment about it all was, I had it myself. I remember when the diocese was actually in the process of trying to, well, we put our hat in the ring, so to speak, in the bankruptcy court for the purchase of the campus. And I remember I was in Rome at the time. I was on a little trip there with some friends. And I remember Monsignor Mike Hare, our classmate, he sent a text message. And this is about the court hearing. He says, we didn't get it. And I remember thinking, thank God, because I thought, like you did,
yes,
how are we going to do this, you know, and
yes,
and all the rest of it. And then the next day, we got it.
Oh, but just that, yeah.
Because at the last minute, Dr. Schuller and his wife intervened with the judge and asked the judge to award the sale to the Catholic Church so it would always remain a church. Chapman University was a higher bidder.
Okay.
But the judge awarded the purchase to Christ Cathedral because the Schulers so earnestly asked that that happen. And we were able to get the generous donations of some people to really give us the funding that we needed to actually make the purchase, the couple of million dollars. And so then we got it. And then the bishop asked me to be the rector and the Episcopal vicar. I always remember Bishop Brown asked me that. And it wasn't Christ Cathedral then. There was no name yet.
Right.
Crystal Cathedral campus. And I said, well, what does that mean? What would I have to do? He said, I don't know. And I said, well, that sounds like a perfect job for me.
Well, look what you've done.
So here we are now. And speaking of here we are now, what's it been like since we've actually had the campus? We've developed it. We've dedicated the cathedral and all the rest of it. In terms of the sense of your parish and you and the connection with the cathedral.
When the capital campaign for the cathedral came up and with a lot of education and time spent, people from the diocese coming, speaking to our parish, and bringing people up here for some tours in the process of raising money, and all the work that you and your wonderful group did here to renovate the campus. There began to be quite a bit of excitement, and looking at this as something, this is ours, not
yes.
theirs up there, but this is ours. Uh-huh. This is our cathedral. At the dedication, the members of our parish community who were there were so thrilled and so honored to be there. And with trying to continue to advertise it, play it up, all the beauty around it, and all the materials that the diocese center, the cathedral campus, sent to parishes to help us, that really helped. That really helped a bit. Of course, then the great COVID came, and I was just thinking this the other day when I was here. I thought, I haven't been inside our cathedral for over a year.
Yes.
And it feels like such a distant memory, and it's beautiful, and it's like I can hardly wait till we get back into it. I remember the dedication, then the ordination of our priests, and then that was pretty well it, the last time for any liturgy that I've been in the cathedral.
Yes, and even that ordination, there were hardly any people allowed to be at it, if you recall.
No, this was the first one right after the dedication. Like in July, remember we held the ordination of
that's
the priest?
That's right.
And so that was that's magnificent.
Right.
The place was packed with people.
Right.
And then, but it was then after that, you know, when other things, because it had been closed for the organ installation.
Yes.
But anyway, gratefully, I have my classmate, Father Christopher, who tells me all about what's going on all the time. But it felt good to walk in it the other day and just look around and say, whoa, well, one day we'll all be back together around this altar.
Yes. Well, and I think the beautiful thing that's happened over the years is that having this cathedral, having this whole campus, has given a lot of people in the diocese a sense of one church in the diocese with a place that symbolizes our unity.
Yes.
In the name of the bishop with Jesus Christ. I remember somebody somewhere along the journey said, you know, having the Christ Cathedral campus is kind of like having a downtown for the Diocese of Orange.
Yes.
And I thought that was a really great connection. And in these times when there can be so much disunity, I think the symbolic nature of a cathedral as a point of unity is really important.
I do too. And I think it was Cardinal Bernardine, the late Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago years ago, who talked about most of us Catholics are congregationalists.
Yes.
And that is that our congregation, our parish, is the central to our life of faith, which is very important. And one of the downsides of that is that we're in it for, like, for example, at St. Timothy Parish, let's take care of us.
Yes.
And I've been trying to push, as other parish pastors are doing, we're part of a whole, something much bigger. And the center that binds us all together under the leadership of our bishop is our cathedral, the mother church of our diocese.
Yes.
And how do we live in union with that.
Very well put. Well, Monsignor, you mentioned the pandemic, and that's had a significant effect on all of us. And when we come back after our break, I want to talk a little bit more about that and what it's been like for you and for your parish and what the changes have been. And also remember that the last segment of our program is a homily and some music from Christ Cathedral. So I hope you'll stay tuned for some more wonderful conversation with Monsignor John.
Have you heard Deacon Steve lately?
From the very beginning of our country, the Declaration of Independence, we talked about a right to life.
The first thing that we have in the preamble, you know, the Declaration of Independence, is we have the right to life.
Isn't that interesting?
One.
The most American thing we can do is supporting life.
Catch Empowered by the Spirit with Deacon Steve Greco, Sundays at 12 noon, right here on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to Cathedral Square. I'm your host, Father Christopher Smith, Rector of Christ Cathedral in the Diocese of Orange. And my special guest today is Monsignor John Urell, pastor of St. Timothy Church in Laguna Niguel. I know all of us have been experiencing the consequences, the effects, the challenges having to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'd like to hear from you. What has happened at your parish? What has been the impact? What are some things that are different for you as a pastor and for your parish community at St. Timothy?
It was horrible when we got the word that we needed to shut down just almost a year ago. Terrible. I said, okay, now what do we do? How are we able to preach the gospel and bring the sacraments when we can't do what we normally would do? And that was the first effect. I'll never forget celebrating Mass in our Blessed Sacrament Chapel in front of an iPad. And that's the only thing to take so I can be recorded celebrating Mass and trying to preach to an iPad, and finding how difficult that was. At the same time, the number of calls and emails and notes of support from the people of the parish who were also beginning to feel this immediate effects of this COVID, they were wonderful, saying, we're with you, we're praying for you, please help us. You know, how can we help you to do what we do as parish the best we can? So the immediate impact, of course, was a total shutdown and nobody was around. And then, of course, economic impact and needing to furlough staff and shut down to everything. And then we were, of course, in Holy Week and Easter.
That's right.
The great celebrations and feeling like, my goodness, you know, where is Easter this year? There are celebrations of it, of course, but where was it? As we've gone through the summer, though, and then now in the fall and then the winter, there's still the strain of pastoring a parish where you can't be together is still there. Although we've certainly evolved with live streaming and with having our masses outside and people coming. For example, this morning at the parish, the 8:30 Mass, there were probably 45 people outside in a very cold, damp environment. And it's amazing, in talking to our brother priests, the number of people who continue to come for masses and liturgies and confessions outside in different arenas because their faith is so strong. That's really nourished mine. Just before coming over here today, I stopped to get a cup of coffee, and there were two men outside this little bagel shop, and they said, so, Monsignor, are we ever going to get back into the church again? And I said, oh, yes. When? I said, who knows when?
Yes,
so
right.
I said, just hang in there. We'll be back one day. So the strain of not being able to be in person with the people of the parish, the concern that I have and many of our brother priests have about our elderly parishioners or sick parishioners whom we cannot visit or have been unable to visit so often and so much, the lack of community, especially for those who live alone or in, you know, small groups, our families with their children with faith formation, trying to be creative. And I've got a very creative staff who are working really hard to make sure that there are some online and how we might even tweak the online programs for our young people. Very grateful for that. One other aspect of our parish life that has just gone over the top is our food pantry.
Oh, yes.
That we have Mondays and Wednesdays, and we were maybe averaging 35 to 40 families a week. On a Monday, a couple of weeks ago, we had 178 families coming. The generosity, the outpouring of generosity of men and women in our parish and young people, different food drives, that's been amazing. And the same thing with our Vincent de Paul Society outreach to help people in need with financial help if we can. So it's a combination of incredible blessings to see the generosity pouring forth in the midst of really restricted ability to get together.
Yes. Well, you know, as I've been thinking about it over these many, many months, with all the lack of in-person contact with people, and so much of being church is about relationship, it's about certainly the in-person relationship, but it's also about the spiritual relationship. And I think that the fact that so many people are participating in Mass via the live stream and coming to the can and all the things that you just described really is testimony that there is a very real spiritual relationship that's our church is all about.
Yes, very much so. And one thing that struck me is that I've always tried to prepare my homilies well.
Yes.
And to now know that when the Mass is live streamed, that homily is up for good
yes.
for a long time.
That's right.
And comments from people all over the country, as I'm sure you have even more so with the larger stage here, but people calling and saying, thank you for that homily, or emailing, and people I don't even know from others, but they're flipping around, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that's one thing I've noticed. And people have been quite honest with me that they love the live streaming part of it in the sense that they're able to listen to different homilies on the same Sunday. And they will.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And grow in faith and be nourished by what they hear from different places. But the spiritual connection of people, I just so look forward to us being able to see each other face-to-face. If I may, recently working with a couple in marriage preparation, I'd never met them before. And after about 15 minutes, we were in a conference room, socially distanced with our masks. I said, can I ask you a favor? Would you just drop your mask so I can see your smile?
Yes.
Oh, it made a world of difference to the couple I'd never met before. And there, I said, okay, fine, put them on. But to have that connection.
Exactly. Well, and also for me, and I'm sure for you too, speaking of preaching, preaching to people with masks on is really tough.
Yes. Yes.
Because, if you really make an eye contact with the people, which I know you do and we do, you can't see how they're reacting.
No.
And it's very tough.
Yes.
Now, I know in my case, I always look for the people who are nodding yes to what I'm saying.
Right.
And I try not to look at the ones that don't have such a great look on their face. But nowadays, everybody has the same look.
The same look.
Uh-huh.
I remember thinking that how when we began this COVID business and having to preach to an iPad and then into a camera and then into a camera with people outside of the church because they were live streaming inside and then out, is how much I depend on the people of God when I'm preaching to keep the word alive, to bring the word alive.
Isn't that the truth? Yes.
And to bring the relationship of Jesus with our people alive in the incarnational moment there, that I depend on seeing how they're reacting.
Yes. That
because
makes a big difference.
When I can't, I can find at times that I can just go inward and so I look forward to the day when we can do this without, and it will come. It really will.
It will.
Our theme for our Lenten program at our parish is Journey Toward Hope, because that's where we are on a journey toward hope, and want to encourage people to hang in there, to keep working together and journey toward hope.
Oh, that's
one of the hopes is to see each other again face to face.
Yes, exactly. Well, looking to the future, what do you foresee looking toward the future in terms of, do you think we're going to go like, as they say, back to normal or do things like we always did again? Or what's your sense about that?
It's really hard to know. At times I feel very optimistic that things will get back to some way of how it might have been, especially when it comes to people gathering for social events.
Yes, exactly.
For gatherings, for coffee and donuts after Mass, just hanging around. Just to be able to do that will make our Sunday liturgical experience so much richer. As far as other issues of bringing people together, well, I don't know. It's given time to think about how we might do some things differently.
Yes.
And one of the great gifts has been this live streaming of liturgy, which we at St. Timothy will plan on continuing after we don't have to.
Right, uh-huh.
Because it brings the Word of God and the celebration of home into people's homes who cannot come. And the number of people who have told me that they are so grateful for that, that's one thing. People are wondering, will people come back to church? Yes, over a period of time, people will. People are hungering for the good, the beautiful, the true. People want to get back to their parish communities. There's a hiatus now. But when I talk to people, who might just drop by to visit or just say they can say a prayer, they're looking forward to coming back. Will it be as usual? No. Whatever that is, usual of people smiling and being with one another's company, that will come back. Maybe some of the format, the structures might not.
Well, yes, and I think we have to be realistic in our expectations, the first Sunday that we're allowed back in the church and we have unlimited capacity.
Yes.
Oh. That Sunday it's going to be full. I don't think so.
No. No. No.
I mean, it'd be wonderful, but I don't think, because people have gotten used to certain ways now. And also, I think people will continue to be cautious about the large scale gatherings.
I do too. And I think too, Father Christopher, that we priests need to support each other in this and not get down or feel we're not doing enough or doing it right when that happens, but to say, that's all right. We welcome who are here. And slowly but surely, things will come and not be discouraged, not be cynical.
Yes.
But rather be hopeful. Be hopeful.
Yes, that's really important. And your point about supporting each other as brother priests is very important too, because like everybody else, we have been disconnected from each other in terms of our in-person gatherings and that kind of thing. And those are the kinds of things that helped us to build our bonds as brother priests.
So important. So necessary.
hopefully that will be part of our life again at some point. But again, who knows?
The point is this. Our faith is incarnational. We are people with each other. We hold hands. We accompany each other. We smile. We cry together. We laugh together. And when we can't do that, our religion can become disembodied.
Yes.
And I think some people are going through the desert of that now, and they're longing to be back so that they can we can be back. To have sick calls where you can actually go.
Yes.
And not worry about, will the hospital let me in or not, even though they're trying to do the best again. All those things. Can we just be back together again? Emmanuel, God is with us. Well, God is with us, and we could be with each other.
Exactly. Well, now, we have been priests for, it will be...
43 years.
43 years.
In June.
In June. As we are coming to the end of this segment, Monsignor, I would like to ask you, what keeps you engaged in this ministry as a priest?
That is a really good question, and the key to me, what keeps me engaged, would be two things of the same import. One is, I love being a priest, and I have fun being a priest. And it's a priest with the people, the parish. I love that. And what keeps me engaged is the opportunities God has given me to accompany men, women, and young people in their journey of faith. That's what keeps me going, to be able to be there to accompany. I love that word of Saint Pope Francis, that we're here to accompany people.
Beautiful word.
That's what strikes me. That's what keeps me going is that. And not just keeps me going, but enlivens me and encourages me and brings me great joy.
Yes.
Great joy.
Well, I love being a priest, and I have fun at it, and I am joyful in it. And you help that happen for me too, Monsignor, and the way you live your priesthood. In Spanish, there's a beautiful phrase, which I've loved forever. And when you show up for something,
yes,
the person says, gracias por acompañarnos.
Acompañarnos.
Thank you for accompanying us.
Oh, my. Yes.
And that's what you and I and us priests really try to do for God's people. Thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Now we're going to take a break. When we come back, there is going to be a homily from Christ Cathedral and some music. Remember, you can listen to Cathedral Square every Saturday on Relevant Radio, AM 1000, every Saturday morning between 11 and 12 noon. And if you miss the live broadcast, you can also look up the podcast on Orange County Catholic and click on radio, and then you'll find the options for the various podcasts. It's been wonderful again to be with you, Monsignor. Thank you so much, and may God's many blessings continue to be yours and all of God's people.
Catholic Radio and podcasts, making a difference for those living on the margins in our communities.
And I drove down to Venice Beach, where I knew it's close to me, and I knew that there's lots of homeless people on Venice Beach. So I went down there, and all I did with nothing in my hands, all I did was go up to homeless people and just say, hi, what's going on? How are you doing? And what the response was an immediate kind of a look on their faces like, you care? You acknowledged? You want to know about me? And I found that they would prefer to just be acknowledged, to just have a conversation, than to just be handed a bottle of water or a buck.
Check out Empowered by the Spirit with Deacon Steve Greco, Sundays at noon on Relevant Radio. Or come find the podcast at occatholic.com/radio. Listening to Cathedral Square. Thanks for tuning in today. Next, we'll hear from Father Christopher Smith in a powerful homily that he delivered on the third Sunday in Ordinary Time. In speaking of God's mercy that is available to all of us every minute of our lives. We'll also enjoy a small sample of some of the glorious music we heard that morning, featuring the talents of cantor Lauren McCall and organist David Ball.
The kingdom of God. Imagine a book with the title, All of the Sins I Almost Committed, But Never Did. All of the Sins I Almost Committed, But Never Did. What do you think that book would be about? Well, it would be about uncommitted sins. And most importantly, a book by that title could well be about God's mercy. God's mercy can be described as God's daily efforts to keep us from sinning. Every day of our lives, God's mercy is there to help us not to sin. Now, if anyone ever could have written a book, All of the Sins I Almost Committed But Never Did, I think the author or authors of that book could be the people of Nineveh, the people in that first reading today. The people of the town of Nineveh were big-time sinners. You name it, they did it, or were doing it. And into the town comes the prophet Jonah. And Jonah says, in effect, if you don't get your act together in 40 days, your whole town is going to be destroyed. Now, you would think that big-time sinners like the people of Nineveh would have laughed this guy out of town. Oh, get out of here. You don't know what you're talking about. Do you think we're going to stop what we're doing? We're having a great old time. No, they didn't laugh him out of town. In fact, amazingly, they listened to what he had to say. And they changed their hearts. They decided they weren't going to keep up their sinful ways. That change of heart of the people of Nineveh meant that they left behind, no doubt, a huge list of uncommitted sins because they decided to change. That's what God's mercy is all about. God's mercy is about helping us not to sin, and it is available to any of us who will let it work in our lives. Today we hear Jesus calling the first apostles. And what does he say when he calls them? The first thing he says is repent. The first thing he says is clean up your act. Get your lives together. And the next thing he says is believe the good news. Believe the gospel. What's the good news? The good news is that our sins don't have to destroy us because of his redeeming love. The good news is that God's mercy is always with us to help us stop harming ourselves or other people through some of the things that we sometimes do. Jesus, when he said, follow me, he was saying, follow me to them and to us. And those words, follow me, are meant for anybody. It doesn't matter who we are, or it doesn't matter what we have done. What matters is that God wants us to be open to his generous mercy in our lives. God's mercy is powerful. God's mercy is persistent. How do I know? And how do you know? Because you could probably, if you're honest with yourself, think of some sinful things that you almost did but didn't. Just remember the times that we almost did give in to a temptation or to an urge to do something wrong and we didn't do it. That is letting God's mercy work. One of the things that I think is really important for us to remember, and I think sometimes we don't remember this, is that we cannot sin accidentally. Oh, I just happened to sin. It was an accident. Oh, I didn't mean it. No. The very definition of sin means that we willfully make a choice to do something that is wrong. And since sin is a choice, it means that we can avoid it by making a choice that is opposite of whatever the sinful action might be. And one of the things that I've learned in my life is that God throws up all kinds of obstacles to help us not sin, but sometimes we don't see them, or we don't pay attention, or we just ignore them. For the people of Nineveh, the huge obstacle that God put in the way of those people continuing their sinful ways was Jonah. The obstacle that God put in the way of their continuing to destroy themselves by their sin was this great prophet, brave enough to come into the town and say, you know, folks, you're messing up. Do something before you are totally destroyed. Jonah was the obstacle to their sinful ways, and they recognized it and listened. You know, there are many obstacles that I think God puts in our lives that could be the obstacles to us actually sinning. It could be the words of a friend who takes us aside and honestly says, you know what? You know, I really think you need to avoid whatever that behavior is that you're doing. I really think you need to get some help because I think you're really hurting yourself, or I think you're really, really hurting your family or your kids or whatever it might be. Sometimes God's mercy comes in the form of mom and dad. Mom and dad who take son and daughter aside and say, you know what? I really don't want you hanging out with those folks because I don't think they're good for you. I'm afraid if you continue to hang out with them, you might get in trouble yourselves. That's God's mercy trying to help you to be good. Or mom and dad saying, you know what? I don't want you to go to the mall. Or I want you to get in at a certain hour. That's God's mercy speaking through them, helping you not to harm yourself or harm somebody else. God's mercy comes to us in the form of our consciences. And yes, our guilty consciences. You know, there's this phrase that I don't like. It's called Catholic guilt. I don't think it's fair. Why? Because guilt, for a moment, is okay. Only for a moment. Not to carry around with us forever, but guilt is okay. Because guilt is that signal that we've done something wrong, and if we listen to it, it can help us not to do it again. Or guilt is that signal that we may do something wrong, and if we listen to it, we won't do it. If we've done something wrong, we ask the Lord's forgiveness and say we won't do it again, and we let the guilt go. We don't carry it around with us. It's to be something temporary. Guilt is like a warning. It's kind of like, you know, the old example of the kid who puts his finger on the hot stove. Ah! And likely, he or she is not going to do that again. Hopefully, they learned by touching the hot stove. Well, there's plenty of opportunities that I've gotten, and I think we get in our lives not to touch the hot stove again. But sometimes we don't listen and we do it. There is a lot that happens in our lives that can help us not to harm ourselves or other people. You know, maybe God's mercy can even come through the words of this homily today. I don't know. You know, if you find yourself sneaking around doing stuff, you know, kind of privately doing stuff, the fact that you're sneaking around probably means that you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. That's a good indicator. That's a good way to let yourself feel God's mercy to keep you from doing something that's not so good. And also, the more that you find yourself not giving in to temptation, the more that you find yourself not doing the thing you were tempted to do is a sign that you're paying attention to the signals, that you're letting God's mercy work in your lives. As I said before, it is a mercy that is available to us every single moment of our lives. You know that book, All the Sins I Almost Committed But Never Did? If it really was written, I don't think it would be a bestseller. The reason? Sin sells. Mercy, not so much. Well, I'll tell you this much, my brothers and sisters in the Lord. I would rather not have a bestseller and much rather have at my side and at our side, God's generous mercy every moment. helping us to be our best selves every single day.
Been listening to the Cathedral Square Radio Show with Father Christopher Smith. To hear this program again or to download the podcast, go to OCCatholic.com and click radio. Be sure to share and tell a friend as well. Have a blessed day.